welcome to the Psychology Sisters podcast.
Just two besties on a quest to normalise the dialogue around mental health. I'm Kat, a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist. In our episodes, we combine our skills, professional and personal experiences with a light sprinkling of science and a dabble of fun to help you to become informed, in control and empowered.
Now let's dive deep into today's episode.
Hello everybody, welcome back to another episode.
Welcome back.
Today we are talking all things personality and we've got actually a bit of a jam-packed episode.
It's going to be a big one.
It's a big one, my favourite kind of episode. But firstly, before we get into personality, Amy, how are you, my darling girl? How is life going?
Oh, much better now that I'm back with you, spending some little bestie time together. had a coffee, so I'm feeling really pepped up and ready to go. Yeah, how's your week been?
I have been working extremely hard, but I've had one of those weeks that I'm feeling like I'm getting on top of my shit pretty much. I have done heaps of wedding stuff this week. I've done heaps of work stuff this week. My week has actually been really good. I'm trying to think of a single... It was my 1 year... I don't know what you call this as
countdown.
A countdown. 1 year countdown.
Yeah.
I'm going to say post-iversary or something like that. Pre-iversary. 1 year countdown to my wedding the other day.
So exciting.
Oh my gosh.
So exciting.
I got really super nervous ever since it's a 12-month mark. I feel like this wedding has been coming on for ages, but yes, it's getting very exciting now.
I'm so excited. Oh, and it sounds like you've had a great week. I love that feeling when you feel like you've ticked everything off your to-do list or you've, you know, accomplished a lot. You've been really productive. That's such a great feeling.
It's so good. And how is yours? Tell me your pit and peak.
So I've had the opposite week to you.
Oh, no.
I feel like I've been inundated and drowning in my to-do list. It just seems to get longer and longer and longer before I can even tick something off. I've got another thing on there, but that's okay. It has just been a gentle reminder to stop saying yes to things that I don't have time for or can't fit in, especially if I'm compromising on my own self-care.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So pit and peak, I would say... My peak is that I'm really excited for today, recording with you, and we're going on a little high tea to celebrate Kat's 1 year countdown to her wedding with the bridal party. So that will be really fun.
I'm very excited. Any excuse for a scone and a champagne.
Woohoo! So I'm super excited for that and to spend some girl time. You know, I think that will be really nice. And my pit, I think, is just that I didn't prioritize self-care this week and I'm feeling a little bit run down and tired, but that's okay. Sometimes you have those weeks and sometimes it can't be avoided.
Having like a new partner as well, that like you just want to see them all the time, you just want to spend all your time with them, and plus you're busy at work. Plus you did your first solo podcast episode the other day. I'm so proud. You're growing up so fast.
It took me so long. I've always appreciated how much time and effort you put into editing, but I think I have a whole new appreciation.
You did really well. Recording on your own is incredibly difficult.
It is.
Recording like with another person, it's easy to bounce off them. But when you record on your own, you need to be really on the ball.
And you're just like, jabba, 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 jabba.
And you laugh at your own jokes. You really realize how much you think that you're really funny when you're recording on your own.
So we are going to jump into talking all things personality today. Like Kat mentioned, we have a bit of a jam-packed episode because Kat and I guess both have some different perspectives on how we'll be discussing personality today. So we will talk about what personality is, if personality can be changed or restructured, how our attachment and our parent, I guess, relation to our parents affects personality, different types of personality, personality assessments you can do, and the whole all-encompassing of personality.
So like any other episode that Amy and I do, this isn't an exhaustive episode on all things personality. Personality is probably one of the biggest research areas within psychology, so it's really, really hard to
cover everything.
So we're just going to talk about a few of the theories behind personalities, the big ones that are used and the ones that we I guess live by. So what is personality? Is defined by the dictionary as the organized pattern of behaviors and attitudes that makes a human being distinctive. Personality is formed by the ongoing interaction of temperament, character, and the environment. So, how would you define personality?
So, I look at personality in terms of temperament and attachment. And I think that comes down to nature or nurture. So that's one type of theory that explains the influence of events outside the world, so your environment, as factors that make the child who they are. So how essentially you come to be you. Mm. The other attributes or features that are inherent in an individual at birth, and that is biological. So the latter may thought to be caused by multiple factors, but most commonly in our Western society, and that's what I'll be referring to, is regarded as linked to our inherited biological genetic structure. So this theoretical approach is what we call temperament. And I acknowledge the vital importance of both inherited genetic traits and attachment in infancy. And that's the basic idea of how personality is created.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, from a biological perspective of how do we develop a personality? Like where does it come from? As Amy was saying, it is a mix of nature versus nurture. So nature is obviously your genetics, and nurture is what Ames was saying. It's your environment. It's your parental attachment. It's your friends. It's experiences you go through. It's maybe if you've had any trauma, anything that's happening in your life. Coupled with your genetics will be a really good predictor of your personality. For example, you could be born a really happy child, but something could happen to you in your life. You could lose a parent, you could lose a loved one, and that could change your personality for the rest of your life. So personality is very dynamic. It's never a constant. Personality does change a lot over the course of a lifetime, and usually it's depending on the developmental age of the person that it can change. Sometimes it can stay the same, but a lot of the times it does change, and sometimes personalities can change in different situations. Like, for example, I'm a very different person at work than on a Friday night at the pub.
Yeah. So the basic idea of temperament research is that all babies do in fact inherit a mix of genes from their parents and do display some basic tendencies over which parents have no control over. So in other words, it is possible for a baby to be born with shyness or being calm or unexpressive, extremely active, very rigid, or inflexible in its reaction to the situations. However, the bundle of traits that a baby inherits constitutes its temperaments is kind of like Kat was saying, it, if you think of a metaphor, it's kind of like music where strings can tune the music either in a tight, sharp way or a loose, flat way. So people, when we talk about an individual as a highly strung person, maybe referring to a temperament where the strings are pulled very tight. And so it doesn't take much to cause the individual to react quite strongly. Maybe that person might be called sensitive or reactive, and they would have a low threshold of response, probably combined with a high intensity of response. So Chess and Thomas came up with three big temperamental categories to explain babies' temperaments, and they are easy, which 40% of babies are easy babies, slow to warm up, 15% of babies are slow to warm up, and difficult or sparky. That's what they're called, yeah.
Sparky.
Wow. Which comprises 10%. So the remaining 35% are mixed and are actually impossible to classify.
Amy, have you heard of type A versus type B?
I have.
Yes.
I think that's the most common way people describe personality.
Yeah,
hey?
It's really is. So type A is your classic. They're really characterized by their competitiveness. They're really highly self-critical. They seem to be people that are never happy with what they've got. Type A are believed to strive towards their goals without feeling a sense of joy in their efforts or accomplishments. They're always the people that are what next. They are characterized by a really high work involvement and are more likely to be in a fight or flight response than the type B. Type A individuals are easily wound up and tend to overreact. So as you're saying before, they're probably highly strung. And they also tend to have a higher blood pressure and are maybe at more risk of a heart attack. So this personality theory was developed by Friedman and Rosenman. They were actually both cardiologists who were studying the prevalence of heart attacks among different personality types. And it's really just taken off since then. So you might hear people saying, oh, she's definitely a type A.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I only really researched this properly about 2 or 3 years ago. I was like, what's a type A? What's a type B? Is there a type C or D or E? So yeah, type A personalities experience a constant sense of urgency, and they always seem to be in a struggle against the clock. You might have been feeling a little bit of a type A in the last few weeks with your work. You're just feeling like there's an urgency, and I think when it's a busy time of the year, it's easy to fall within the type A category of just needing to get everything done before the holidays start. Often people who have a type A personality become impatient with delays. They don't like waiting in traffic or in queues. They don't like unproductive time, and they schedule commitments too tightly. And they try to do more than one thing at a time, such as reading while eating or watching television or doing work on public transport or while they're exercising.
Oh,
yeah, classic type A. I always thought I was a type B, but after reading this, I'm like, oh my goodness. Type A tends to be easily aroused to anger or hostility. They don't have much patience, whether they do express this overtly or not. They tend to see the worst in others, displaying anger, envy, and a lack of compassion. So type A, there's not a lot going for the poor type A's, are there?
No, it does sound quite negative when you read it, but I think it's important to keep in mind that while you might, I guess, fit into a type A, it doesn't mean that you're going to have all the classifications of a type A.
Yeah.
It might just be the one that you relate to the most.
Yeah, and you can have different type A qualities at different times in your life. So type B, let's talk about type B. People with type B personalities tend to be more tolerant of others. They're more relaxed than type A individuals. They're more flexible. They're more reflective. They experience lower levels of anxiety, and they can display a higher level of imagination and creativity. They're usually quite open-minded, and they usually can respond to change really, really well. So although this model, it is really handy to kind of start to look into personality and the personality types, it is extremely limiting. As we were saying before, not everybody fits into these two categories, but most people are usually on a sliding scale between the two. So usually you might have a little bit of your type A, for example, at work, whereas at home you might be more of a type B person or vice versa. So don't think that one is better than the other. Type A are extremely productive, and they're more likely to accomplish their goals. And type B are usually not as likely to accomplish their goals. So it is, you know, I think type A has got such a negative, you know, when people say, oh, she's a type A, like it's a really bad thing.
It does have a negative connotation, doesn't
Whereas
it?
Type B seems to be the more chill, relaxed, easygoing one. So yeah, as we're saying, people are more likely to fit in a sliding scale between these two.
And I think
two.
It's important to note that there are no good or bad personality types. Like, there's no such thing as being a bad personality type.
I agree. Yeah, there's no – and it changes. Personality can change over – like, I'm trying to think of, you know, I maybe was a very different person 5-10 years ago than I am now.
I guess because our personality is biological as well as it is a result of – our attachment and our environment. Some parts of our personality are fixed. However, we can definitely change habits and different things that we do that might not be serving us well as a result of maybe things that we've learnt. Those things can be changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's how we grow, because we learn that, okay, maybe this part of my personality isn't something I like about myself or isn't something that serves me well. So we can adjust those things.
For example, I guess being stubborn in a relationship, that can be a huge roadblock to a successful relationship. So people who are stubborn and do like to get their way, they might want to work on that, and they might want to work on ways to be not as stubborn, because it in the interest of their relationship. So it is possible to change, and it is okay to change. You're not stuck with, I guess, what you've been born with. You can change consciously, and it does change unconsciously too sometimes. So personality is really a very dynamic. It's always changing. It's never constant. As Amy's saying, there's no good or bad personality at all. So another theory, so we've got the type A and type B. Another one I wanted to bring to the table was the big five personality types. Amy, have you heard of the big five before?
I have heard of the big five.
Of course you have. Have you studied psychology?
I mean, only for 6-ish years.
No big deal. So this is probably one of the most used personality predictor within psychological research. And this was developed originally by Robert McCrae. And he believes that there are five major personality traits that shape who we are. And these are openness, conscientiousness, introvertedness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And researchers believe that we all lay somewhere between the scale of each one. So, openness. What do you think openness means?
So, openness, I think, is about having curiosity, having interest, and I guess being prepared to adjust or modify any experience and take on new ideas.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. So people who are open or have expressed a high level of openness, they are very open-minded, they're very insightful and creative. They are curious about the world and other people, and they're eager to learn new things and enjoy new experiences, such as traveling. These people may be more likely to be open-minded and more likely to be able to shift their beliefs and perspectives than maybe others. Mm. So people who are high in this trait tend to be more adventurous and creative. People low in this trait are often much more traditional and may struggle with flexible thinking. Mm. So I think this is something that really sparked my interest with openness, is because it seems as though one way to increase openness and open-mindedness could be traveling.
Mm.
I think, you know, after you go for a really big trip somewhere, whether it's overseas, especially I found to a third world country, this can really help to shape that openness, can't it? Because it really, especially your first trip out of Australia, you know, when you were younger and you went for your first overseas trip,
yeah.
I think when you get that feeling of like, oh my God, like, wow, we're so lucky in Australia, and it just really opens you up to other experiences. So I think that this is a really good one that can be shaped, especially by traveling
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you hear that a lot when people come back from traveling, that they are so much more appreciative of where they come from. They might have different values, and they might be more prepared to be open to new experiences and trying new things than they had been previously.
Yeah, they're more open to new cultures, how other cultures work, and it's not just Australian culture. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to, if you're someone who feels like you're not very open-minded, travel. Take advantage of the Black Friday sales.
Or try things that are new, like even just food. Go to a different restaurant. Like I went to an Afghan restaurant.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't even know it was there. Mm. I'd never had Afghan food before. It was delicious.
Yeah.
Loved it. Yeah.
Any Middle Eastern food is delicious, hey?
So good.
The next one that McRae thought that people fell into was probably a really common one, is extroversion versus introversion. So you probably know what extroversion is, but it is characterized by excitability, sociability, being really talkative, liking to go to events, and being really assertive. People who are high in extroversion or extroverts are outgoing and tend to gain energy in social situations.
Mm.
Being around other people helps extroverts feel energized and excited, and they're very action-oriented. So people who are introverted tend to be more reserved and have less energy to expend in social settings. People who are low in extroversion tend to lose energy in social situations, and it can feel draining. Mm. Introverts do require a period of time in order to recharge, and they are thought oriented. So
yeah, so we've got shy on one end and outgoing on the other. And I think when we speak about introversion versus extroversion, we usually say introversion are those who get their energy from time to themselves and in solitude, and extroversion is where you get your energy and you fill your cup from spending time with others.
Yeah, it's a really big difference, and it's really good to know, you know, your personality and where you kind of can fit in. Obviously, it's not limited to introverts and extroverts, but sometimes it's good to know that if you're someone who does feel like you like to be alone, there's nothing wrong with that. Ames, I think you and I are both introverts. We get our energy from being alone. And if you're an introvert, you're more likely to be, I guess, quite open to other people and be a really good listener. And you tend to be someone who cares a lot for other people, and that can be quite draining.
Mm.
Not saying that extroverts don't, but I'm saying as an introvert, you're more likely to listen rather than talk. And sometimes you can take all that in, and you need a time to yourself to feel like get that recharge.
It's almost
energy.
Like a download, isn't it? Like that's how I kind of feel when I'm spending time in my own, you know, spending time by myself in solitude, it's almost like downloading everything from the week or downloading from social events and recharging.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like literally plugging yourself into a wall and recharging. Whereas people who are extroverted, they need that social energy in order to get that energy for themselves.
To pep them up.
And people who are extroverted do not like being alone. They like to be around other people and have company. So, but as we were saying before, extroversion and introversion is a sliding scale. You don't have to be totally one or the other. You can be in the middle and it can change. I mean, if you're someone that likes to go out on a Friday night and you're an introvert, that doesn't mean that there's something, you know.
Just or something might happen and you might go through a period of time where you become really introverted or really extroverted.
Absolutely. I think maybe when you're younger and you like to start going out and partying, you can become very extroverted. Maybe as you get a bit older and you've got other responsibilities, maybe introversion is more common. So it'd be interesting to study that over the timeline of someone's life. Okay, so another one of the big five personality types, people who are very conscientious. So people who are thought to be in the conscientiousness scale are more likely to be thoughtful, they have good impulse control, and they're more likely to achieve their goals as they have a lot more goal-directed behaviors. Highly conscientious people tend to be organized and are mindful of the small details. They plan ahead, think about how their behavior affects others, and are very mindful of deadlines. So people who are low in conscientiousness, they don't like structure, they don't like schedules, they think of time as if it's their own, and they're very flexible with time, like
so
me.
Someone that doesn't have a lot of conscientious traits may be described as scattered, irresponsible or careless.
Lazy.
Yeah, lazy.
They don't like routine. They make messes and they don't take care of their things. People who are low in conscientiousness in the scale, they might forget or fail to return things or put them back where they belong. They might be really big procrastinators, and they don't complete necessary or assigned tasks on time. They may be late with those things. So going through that, I was like, oh my goodness, this was totally me at uni. I procrastinated. I didn't like schedules. I was really lazy. So it can come at different times, and we're all on a scale.
And the first thing I thought of when, you know, as we're going through this is how people may be perceived as, especially in the work environment, as not conscientious if they suffer from anxiety, because anxiety can be really debilitating and make us avoid things. I feel like that's really important to know about your personality as well, if you are someone that may actually have a lot of goals and, you know, like structure, however you procrastinate and you're avoiding things. I guess I'm just thinking of how that is perceived by others as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's more than meets the eye sometimes. If someone is lazy or if someone is low in the conscientiousness scale who procrastinates, as you were saying, there could be more going on. I mean, there could be something going on.
And that could influence, personality.
Exactly. Mental health has a really big influence on personality, especially depression. I feel like people with anxiety not maybe severe anxiety, but maybe the low to moderate anxiety, they might be able to hide their anxiety quite well. But I feel like people who have high anxiety, who have quite severe anxiety or depression, that can really take a toll on your personality and can change your personality.
And it can make others see you as that's just them. So if you are someone that has chronic depression, people might just know you as being, you know, pretty mellow, pretty...
Like that's your personality.
That's just who you are. Yeah, that's not abnormal. And I feel like that's where it goes so uncovered for so long. Because you can't see it. It just looks like that's just who they are.
Yeah, they're just someone with depression, which is so not true. People who have depression usually feel like their personality is blunted because they don't have the energy, they don't have the want or the desire to go and be who they really want to be. So it's really interesting when you look at personality that there is always more than meets the eye.
How it's affected by different mental illness.
So many different things, So the second last one of the big five, the fourth one, is agreeableness. So this personality dimension, agreeableness, includes attributes such as trust, altruism, kindness, affection, and other pro-social behaviours. People who are high in this, in the agreeableness scale, tend to be more cooperative and people-pleasing, while those low in this trait tend to be more competitive and sometimes even manipulative.
Or gullible.
As I said, people who are high have a great deal of interest in other people. They care about other people. They feel quite empathetic and they have a lot of concern for other people. They enjoy helping and contributing to the happiness of other people. And people who are high also assist those who are in need of help. People who are high in this scale might also be in a helping profession, such as a nurse, social worker, counselor, etc. People who are low in this dimension have little interest in others. They don't care about how other people feel. They have little interest in other people's problems. They might insult or belittle others, and they often manipulate others to get what they want. So this is a really interesting one, and it really interesting is how this could change. I'm just trying to think, when you're a child, you would automatically be low because as a child, you don't really take interest in others when you're that young, because when you're a child, you have that the whole world revolves around you kind of mindset. You have little, I guess, acknowledgement of the world around you. You don't care about how other people feel. You might, you know, insult or belittle others, or you might manipulate others to get what you want. And then as you get older, I wonder if that agreeableness would increase with just being around other people and having more awareness of other people. What do you think you are on the agreeableness scale?
Well, I do tend to be a little bit of a people pleaser, and I can be quite gullible. So there are definitely aspects of agreeableness that I have as traits in my personality. I don't know, it's hard because there are definitely times when I don't know. What do you think you are?
I think you're pretty high on the agreeableness scale. I think this is all you. You have a lot of interest, you have a lot of empathy.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm manipulative though.
No, definitely not. Like the opposite of manipulative.
And I feel like agreeableness can also be ingenuous. So I feel like that can be the other end of agreeableness as well, is that if you are, and I guess that is something that I can do as well out of being a people pleaser, is agree to things without really wanting to. So I guess that is disingenuous. I would say moderate. I'm going to say moderate on the agreeableness.
Okay, the last one of the big five, number five, is neuroticism. Neuroticism is a trait characterized by sadness, moodiness, and general emotional instability. Individuals who are high in this trait tend to experience a lot of stress. They may worry about different things. They might get upset easily, and they might experience dramatic shifts in mood. They also struggle to bounce back after stressful events, or they may feel anxious. People who are low in neuroticism may be more emotionally stable. They might be able to deal well with stress. They rarely feel sad or depressed. They don't worry too much, and they're very relaxed. So I think this is a really important one to take note, is that I don't think that this model, well, I'm sure that this model does not take into account mental health and mental illness. So as we were talking about before, people who are high in neuroticism, it really is describing people who are anxious or depressed. And as we were saying before, this model does not take into account the experience of mental health and how mental health can change.
And also it doesn't take into account that it is so normal for our moods to fluctuate. So I know when we speak about neuroticism, we're speaking about being moody and discontent, and some of those things are so normal for human beings to experience daily. It is normal for our emotions to fluctuate in response to events and situations, and for in other situations as well. So like I know for myself, when it's that time of the month, my mood fluctuates, and you know, I can be a bit neurotic when it's that time of the month, but that's normal for that circumstance, exactly. That event.
That's what I think, that this model, it is a great model, but it's also very limiting because it doesn't take into effect people's experiences in terms of course, if you were I don't know, for example, you're someone going through the bushfires at the moment, you're going to experience a lot of stress. You're going to worry about lots of different things. You're going to get upset easily. You're going to feel anxious and you're going to struggle to bounce back. That doesn't mean you're highly neurotic. That means you're responding appropriately
to a situation.
To a situation. So I think that this is a great model and it's a great, you know, way to start off into learning about personality, but it also does have its limits. This study does have its flaws and it's not a really accurate representation. It does not take into account, I guess, the environmental stress that may be occurring for people or the mental health of people.
Definitely. So like I mentioned, when I talk about temperament and personality, I look at how parenting can modify temperament. So there are a number of ways, some obvious, some subtle, in which the way a child is parented might encourage or inhibit some of the genetic traits associated with personality and temperament. So a child that might be highly expressive, loud, and reactive, who has parents that constantly react calmly and non-punitively to this form of behavior, the child will most likely remain highly expressive and sensitive, but it won't escalate to the point of extreme behavior because there is no incentive to do so. So there's no vicious cycle of escalating blame or shouting in which the parent's reaction to the child's behavior teaches the child to escalate it. So when a child is, I guess, responded to in an appropriate way, it's teaching the child that's okay, that it's okay to be expressive. You can show emotions and it's safe to do so. So in behavioral terms, this would be an example of, I guess, a lack of reinforcement because we're without, you know, being punitive on expression, we're teaching the child that that's okay.
And that's acceptable.
And that's acceptable. So parents, usually just one of the two, but sometimes both, may model a particular behavior which encourages the child to feel that this behavior is normal and even desirable. This is a different kind of reinforcement and a more obvious one, but it is still reinforcement. So parents may actively attempt to inhibit particular traits in their child, and this will teach new behavior because maybe they don't like it or they don't approve it. So say, for example, you have a shy child and you're trying to make the child less shy. If they do so gently, persistently, and with sensitivity, they may get a measure of success. The trait will not go away, but the child might learn to express themselves in a different way and it won't be bad for the child. It won't be negative. However, another common response is to make conscious attempts to teach new behavior that the child reacts against to feeling a sense of disapproval from their parents. And consequently, that trait is then reinforced. And the child feels in the spotlight and a layer of shame becomes associated to the expression of that trait. So parents can and often do interpret their child's behavior in terms of their own values and beliefs. And that may, in fact, read the child's actions quite incorrectly, imposing their own template for behavior on their child. So normal exploration and curiosity might be seen as naughty or challenging. And then if parents punish that normal behavior of curiosity because they're interpreting that as naughty behavior, that can have a blunting effect on their temperament or personality.
Yeah, so it's very clear that parents have a huge effect on our personality. And often as we get older, it's really interesting because you know, when you're younger and you think, oh, I never want to be like my mom or I never want to be like my dad. And then you can eventually turn into your mom or your dad. So it's really, really interesting how parents, as always, we always say this, have a huge effect on your psychology and personality.
Definitely. And one thing I will just quickly mention too is that birth order. So if you have siblings, your birth order can also influence your temperament and your personality. So for example, firstborns only have limited time alone with parents, and that plays a role in, I guess, teaching them how to be, their environment.
And they're quite independent.
Yeah. So they're I guess, and they're also more entitled to special treatment for that short period of time too. So firstborns tend to be more serious and responsible. They're more focused on achievement. They're more concentrative, and they're more likely to be perfectionists as well.
Yeah.
Whereas the last born misses out on all those teachings, and they're more likely to experience jealousy, and they're more likely to, I think statistics show, they're more likely to be less academic. So their academic performance is usually lower, according to studies.
And the last born, I've noticed with my clients, they grow up really quickly, because when you have older siblings that model mature behavior of their appropriate age, the youngest child or the last two youngest ones will model the oldest sibling's behavior, forcing them to grow up quickly and to mature quickly.
Yes, and the parental feedback theory suggests that the less kids you have, the less anxious you'll be as a parent. So parents play an indirect role in the children, as we've discussed through attachment theory. And studies show that through this parental feedback theory, that the less kids you have, the less anxious you'll be. Therefore, you'll have a higher probability of having a secure attachment.
Wow.
Having children that have a secure attachment.
And the stress of having a lot of children would probably definitely play into that. So I have another really cool, this is my favorite of all the personality theories. I say the best to last. This one is the Myers-Briggs 16 personality types. And this is based on Carl Jung. He's a really awesome theorist who studies personality, and his original work was exploring the different personality traits that occur on the scale between introversion and extroversion. However, Myers-Briggs took this one step further, and it was made up of four personality traits, and they have developed a model, and the personality traits are analysts, diplomats, explorers, and sentinels. Amy, have you seen the 16 personality types before?
I have, and this particular personality test that you can do is really common for employers to use.
Absolutely, yeah. So personality tests are really important in employment. You might get them. You might have to do one for your job. They do a lot of personality testing for your job because people like to know what kind of person you are, especially.
And whether you fit the role.
Yeah, and whether you fit the team. It's also, they use personality testing in high schools, or if you're not sure what your career path is, to decide what career might be suited for you. So yeah, personality testing is really important. Or even just knowing what kind of person you are and giving you that extra clarification that, you know, oh yes, I am this kind of person, and yes, that is me, and there are others that are like me, and I'm not weird, or I'm not different. I think normalizing your personality can be really helpful for some people as well, because I feel like I've gotten a lot of clients before who feel like they are really weird, and they are really, you know, especially my introverted clients, they tend to think that they're the only introverts in the world. So sometimes doing personality tests can be really good at clarifying and knowing that you're not alone, and knowing that there's others out there, and it's okay to, I don't know, for example, be really quiet, or to be shy, or to be reserved, or to be loud, or to be excitable. So it's completely a really good tool for that. So the 16 personality types, it's actually really popular at the moment, this test. You can do it online, and you might have seen people putting their results up, and it's like the INTJ kind of results. So it's a four-letter acronym that stands for certain personality traits. So I'll go through each of the major four personality types, and there's four kind of traits within each one, but we don't have enough time today, so I'm just going to go through the major ones. So before we go into this, Amy, have you done this test online before?
I have. I did it a while ago when I was doing personality in my undergrad degree, and I always remember I was the console.
The console. So the console.
All I remember out of that was they were meant to be popular, which I'm definitely not. So I was like, well, and that's where we come back to, not all of the criteria will relate to you, but there'll be one that relates to you the most.
Yeah,
so that one I obviously scored the highest on, and I remember there were people pleasing aspects in there. I think that one is
really
selfless, yeah. High on empathy, those types of traits, which I do have. However, it was interesting because it was also, you know, likes attention, is popular, those type of things, which I guess I can be, But the whole popular thing didn't really fit me too well.
And I think that is what we're kind of saying before. It's really interesting to note before we go into this is that as humans, we love to fit in boxes. We love everything to be clear cut and perfect. But with personality, unfortunately, personality is not clear cut. It's never perfect and it's always evolving and changing.
Nothing in psychology is ever clear cut.
Nothing ever. So before, if you do this test, please know that, like Amy, you might not fit every single criteria, but it might give you more of an idea of where you fall under each category. So Amy, you were saying you're the console, and the consoles are part of a group of personalities called the sentinels. So the sentinels, they are usually very observant and judging. They are cooperative and practical. They are very grounded and they like being individualistic, and they like to work alone. So people who are sentinels are more likely to be an accountant, they're more likely to be in management, they're more likely to be in a police, or they're more likely to be a nurse or lawyers or maybe in counseling. The next one is the analyst. So the analyst personality type is fairly rare, and analysts pride themselves on their inventiveness and creativity, the unique perspective, and their vigorous intellect. Usually known as the philosopher, their career path might be a philosopher, an architect, a scientist, and logicians who are part of the analysts have been responsible for many scientific discoveries throughout history. So analysts are your real numbers and science kind of people. They're real analytical. They could be philosophical as well. So certainly not me. Now we have the diplomat. So I was a diplomat and I came under the mediator. So I'm going to click on it now. So, oh my God, this is so me. Mediated personality is a true idealist, always looking for the hint of good, even in the worst of people and situations. So diplomats who fall under the mediator category tend to be warm, caring, and generous individuals, shining in diplomacy and counseling. These personality types promote cooperation and harmony. They tolerate conflict and only like conflict as if it steps towards positive change, where I like conflict, so maybe that's a little bit different to me. And they're more likely to be in careers of counseling, advocacy, charity work, nurse, social worker. And then the last one is my personal favorite. So in this test, if you fall under this one, I'm totally jealous. The last one is explorers. Mm. So the explorers are the venturers. They're creative and they love experiencing new things. They have a strong sense of self, valuing their me time for introspection, goal setting, and assessing their principles, and also for their downtime. Although they're kind and warm to each other, their top priority is to be the person they want to be, which is why they have a tendency to take criticism poorly. They make up 9% of the population, making them the fourth most common personality type. So their strengths include being artistic, charming, imaginative, curious, sensitive to others, and very passionate. And meanwhile, their weaknesses is that they tend to become very easily stressed. They're very overly competitive. They're unpredictable. They're fiercely independent and they have very unpredictable self-esteem. So the career paths for these type, for the explorers, can be artists, musicians, chefs, travelers, entrepreneurs, flight attendants, photographer, fashion designers, anything in the creative arts, explorers will really thrive. This is a really fantastic test and you can do this online, and it goes through, if you go through, I think it takes like 10 minutes to test, you can do it online. It is based on psychological theory, so it's not like just a random one that's got no basis at all. It's actually got quite a strong foundation, and it goes through, once you figure out which one you are, it'll go through your strengths and weaknesses, how you are in romantic relationships, how you are in your friendships, what you're likely to be as a parent, what are some good career paths, your workplace habits, and giving you an overall conclusion how to kind of work on your weaknesses. So it's a really, really fantastic, it's just 16personalities.com. You just type that in and it will kind of get you through to the test and you can start to become, figure out which personality you are. So rate this one.
Is good. Another one I love and one that I personally use is the Risso-Hudson Enneagram Type Indicator. And I don't just like it because it has my name in it.
Did you make this, Amy Hudson?
I wish. So it's used frequently by psychologists and therapists, and it's a geometric figure that maps out 9 possible personality types and their complex interrelationship. So it's about recognizing our core drivers as well as the impact of our experiences, motivations, attitudes, and fears. So it is a really good one because it's flexible. It recognizes that you might be a personality type and it has when you're feeling good and also like when you're healthy and well, and it also has when you're at your worst, what your personality might be like then. So it is a fluctuating personality, I guess, criteria, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a bit more accurate.
It's a bit more sophisticated in its, you know, design, because a lot of the ones that we've read out today and a lot of the other ones that are out there are not fluctuating, and personality is extremely unpredictable and up and down. So that's really good that it takes that into account.
Yeah, and the Enneagram takes into account, I guess, it says that we all have one core personality type, but it takes into account our fears. It takes into account the messages and needs that weren't met in childhood. So it really is, I feel, a great fit to kind of explain personality and temperament. So we get a bit of the inborn orientation, which determines the ways in which we learn to adapt to early childhood environment. And also, like I said, takes into account fluidity of personality. So I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I would personally use. So it does give you a numerical ranking of your core or basic. When we talk about the Enneagram, they call it your basic personality type.
So what did you get on it?
I am the type 2, which is the helper. And it says that we are devoted, giving, and self-sacrificing. We tend to be generous and warm, and we are frequently aware of the needs and emotional dynamics of others. So we like to feel needed, and we like to take care of people. We need a sense of camaraderie and affection with others. It says we may struggle to take care of our own needs, and we can become consumed with taking care of others. Some of the negative things about the type 2 is that when we feel that we are being overly generous and caring for someone else and that isn't appreciated, we can become resentful. And I definitely see that in myself sometimes. So there are 9 different Enneagram types, and I won't go into all of them because we would be here for an eternity, because you can have a type 4 with a left wing of 5 and a type 6 with a right wing of, you know, 7. Yeah, because it is so fluid and flexible.
Yeah.
There's so much to the Enneagram types, but I feel that I just love this tool for describing personality. And you can do an online test. So if you just type in Risso Hudson Enneagram test and you go into the Enneagram Institute, should come up first.
We can put this on our show notes.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
In my head, I was like, how do you spell Risso?
R-I-S-O.
R-I-S-O. So like miso with an R.
Yeah, miso, Risso. So you can do the Enneagram test online and see what you get. I will just say the 9 types, just so you're kind of aware if it feels like might be something you're interested in. So you've got type 1, which is the reformer, and they are determined, idealistic, and principled. Type 2, which is the helper, like I went into. You've got type 3, the achiever, they're motivated by success and accomplishment. Type 4, the individualist, so they're very sensitive, self-aware, and creative. The investigator, they're very skeptical and curious, and that's type 5. You've got type 6, which is the loyalist, and they're responsible and security orientated. Then you've got type 7, which is the enthusiast, they're very energetic, enthusiastic, and spontaneous. You've got type 8, which is the challenger, and they're very self-confident, assertive, and protective people. And then you've got type 9, the peacemakers. They're very easygoing, supportive, conscientious people who are skilled at creating harmony. So they're the centers. And like I said, you've got all these different other wings, and it sounds complicated, but once you do it, it makes so much sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of what we have time for, personality, but we just wanted to really end and say that I know we've said this about 100 times during this episode, but this is a very limiting way to look at personality, and personality is really incredibly difficult to measure, and there are flaws within each theory. So it's personality is changing, and it's, and personality tests are usually self-report, and self-report can be very subjective, and on one day you could be feeling really calm and really empathetic, and the next day you might have just been had a really tough time getting through traffic and you're stressed, and you're going to score very differently the next day.
Or you might get a personality type that you don't like,
so
you do might it again. Answer it to get a personality type that you're more you favor more.
And especially when you're in a job and they give you personality types, I've had so many of these, you answer as though what they want to hear rather than what you are actually truthful with. Because some of the questions I've had, I don't know what personality test I was doing, but it was like, I remember I had this one, and it was like, if you had, this is really crude and really kind of awful, if you had a gun and you had your mother and your brother, who would you shoot first?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was really savage. So sometimes they can throw you off with these personality questions. Hopefully you will never get one like that, but I definitely know the Defence Force. I have a few family members in the Defence Force. They get personality testing kind of really similar to that. So please don't answer what you think will please everybody else or what you want to be. Please answer honestly with your personality test, but please know that it is also flawed. If you get a personality that you don't like or that you don't think is really you, then that's okay. And also its reliability and validity is really questionable in personality tests. But
and remember that nobody fits into a box.
No.
Like, human beings are so complex. And like we said, our emotions fluctuate. We're fluid. So we're not always going to fit the criteria of a personality specifically. There are going to be things that relate to you and things that don't. And that's normal.
And you can have a dabble of each. You can be a little bit introverted, a little bit extroverted. You can be a little bit of the helper and a little bit of the type A. And that's okay. We're not all meant to be in one category.
Yeah, you'll have one that you relate to the most, but there might be a few things that don't fit you.
Absolutely. So. Okay, it is our favorite time of the potty.
Q&A.
We need to have like a little jingle for Q&A.
We do.
Q&A. We'll just sing it now because we're such great singers. Okay, we have got heaps of questions that you guys wrote to us on our Instagram poll. By the way, I know I say this, like I said on the Instagram story, but thank you guys so much for your responses. We got a lot of responses. Very
overwhelming. And we really appreciate you interacting with us. And
it makes our day when we get a DM from you guys. So just a little thank you. Okay, we have got one question and we've got time to answer. All right, so how to deal with the anxiety brought on by the notion of school reunions?
Great question.
Really good question. We are at the age, well, I'm certainly at the age where it starts to be our 10-year school anniversary. And this is a really great time because it is certainly something that has been brought up more than a few times with me about anxiety and school reunions. Have you been to a school reunion, Amy?
I actually haven't, no.
Okay. School reunions are really... I went to one, I think it was last year or the year before, and it was really, it was a really weird experience. I remember coming home and telling you like, oh my God, Amy, it was such a odd because everybody was 10 years older, but at the same time, they still looked similar. And some of them were doing exactly the same things and some of them were so different. So it was a really weird, like it felt like I was in a time warp where people had aged, but we'd all kind of gotten together. I don't know. It was a very strange experience. And some people are so different to what you remember them as. Some people have really grown up or some people are off doing amazing things and then some people are exactly the same.
And I think that's where the anxiety comes from is, you know, wanting, not wanting to look like you haven't changed or I feel like the expectation is, oh my gosh, it's been 10 years. I need to look like I've got my life together. I'm successful. Or
it's like the battle of who's got the most going on, like who's got the best life. And I think that's such a mythical anxiety that we all have. And we want to put on our, especially if you're someone in school who maybe wasn't the most popular or maybe slid under the radar a little bit, you almost want to prove to other people, like, look at me, I've done really well. I'm killing it here. I'm killing it there. Or maybe if you're someone who was a bit more popular in high school, you want to maintain that popularity or you want to maintain that power and that status and you think, look, I'm still really popular. I'm still really good.
Or maybe if you were someone that was bullied a lot in school or you went through a really tough time with peers, I can imagine that going to a school reunion would bring on so much anxiety.
Yeah.
Because you will potentially be in a room with people that, you know,
could re-trigger your anxiety.
Yeah, that could be traumatic. And, you know, you might not want to put yourself in a position where you are going to be around people that, you know, really hurt you and you have a lot of negative experiences in association too.
And I think that's really where the worry comes from is my school reunion going to be like how it was at high school? Are people exactly the same or have people changed? And I think that's a really, really good question to ask. And also ask yourself why. What are you worried about will happen? What is the worst that could happen? I mean, it's been 10 years since school. And you've survived whatever it is you got through. High school's tough, man. I mean, high school's really tough.
It is a dog-eat-dog jungle.
If you can survive high school, you can literally survive anything. So questioning your anxiety, questioning what is it that's making you anxious and what is the worst-case scenario? What's the worst that could happen? And also really important to have your support network. I know a lot of high school reunions, they ask you to invite a partner if you'd like, but if not, reconnecting with old friends. Can be actually a really nice thing. There actually could be some nice things about a high school reunion.
Yeah. It sounds like it depends on your experience at high school as to where that worry will come from, where that anxiety will come from.
And also the maturity of the other people around you now. It's been 10 years. Are they similar to what they were? Or are they totally different and maybe a little bit more grown up? I think that's really interesting. So completely understand the anxiety.
And whether you stayed connected with people from high school. Like I know for myself, I haven't really stayed connected with the people that I spent time with at high school. So for me to go to a high school reunion, it would be like walking to a room full of strangers.
And maybe for some other people, like I know for my year 12, I felt really connected to my year group. I felt really, we all went through this really special thing together. And even though there was certain different groups and conflicts and people that maybe didn't get along, we all had this shared experience that was really special and that nobody else went through except us. And I think that's why people have reunions, because it's almost like, wow, we had a really great time in high school. I always look back on high school. I'm very lucky and privileged that I get to do this, but it was quite fun times. Like I had a really great time in high school. It was hard, but I had, you know, I really felt connected to everyone that was in my grade. So, you know, it also depends on, I guess, the experience that you know, if you had a good one or a bad one. Yeah. But I think that the fact that maybe people are organizing it is such a, you know, it is a nice thing that people are doing and they're just wanting to maybe catch up with everyone and see how you're going. But, you know, you don't have to go. If it's something that's really causing a lot of anxiety, then you do not.
I think that's something that you could ask yourself. How would you feel if you didn't go to your high school reunion?
Would you wish that you went? No, would you? It's, you know, no one's forcing you to go. You totally.
And you don't have to stay. No. If you go there and you don't feel comfortable and you want to leave, you can leave.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and also after high school, no one's popular anymore. Like we're all kind of equal after high school. High school seems to have a ranking hierarchical system, but after high school kind of just goes away. Have you noticed that?
I have, only because I work in a school now. I'm probably the most popular I've ever been as a school psych. So don't know about you, but still pretty popular.
I bet you can't wait for your school reunion. Can't wait. You're like, I'm Amy and I'm the most popular girl at school now.
All
finally.
The kids love me.
It's taken me 10 years, but started from the bottom, now we're here. So yeah, it is really interesting to see it from the other side, working in schools, as you were saying, because it's like, oh my God, I hope that wasn't me. I hope I wasn't the cool group and the uncool group.
I definitely wasn't.
That definitely dissolves after high school. Well, it did for me anyway. I mean, I'm really speaking from personal experience. It does dissolve after high school and everybody's on even playing fields. And some people do really well, which is so cool. It's nice to catch up with, you know.
Yeah.
It can be a really nice thing. So I would strongly recommend, as someone who went to one a few years ago, to go. It's a really great, you know, thing to catch up with people. But if it's, I would recommend, if it's causing a lot of anxiety, to have a support network, have a way to get out. You know, you don't have to stay for long. Or if it's really causing that much anxiety, then you don't have to go. It's totally okay if you don't go. The world's not going to end if you don't go. But, you know, could be a nice thing to go to. So good luck with that.
Yes.
Make sure you have your coping mechanisms, your breathing. Make sure you know, whatever it is else you need, a support network. Make sure they're waiting in the car for you. So good luck for your high school reunion.
Yeah, good luck. I hope if you go, it's an enjoyable experience.
And I hope it's not as bad as what you're expecting. Just remember, everyone is probably just really happy to be there and to catch up with everyone.
And everybody probably has a little bit of anxiety going into a school reunion, because you want to exceed expectations, or you want to fulfill your expectations.
Yeah.
And show people that you're successful or, you know.
And even if you haven't done, if you feel like you haven't done much, then that's okay too. It's, you know, high school reunions maybe can be a bit of a comparison and it's,
or a competition. Yeah. And take that out of, take that out of the equation. It's not a competition.
Absolutely not. And it's okay if you feel like people have done other stuff. That totally is fine. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you or you're weird or you've done anything wrong.
Everyone's on their own path and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no right or wrong way how to do life.
Yeah. So just being happy for that other person and, you know, and being happy for you. I mean, you're where you're meant to be. So just remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alrighty, guys. We will catch you next episode. We are talking all things grief next episode.
And loss.
We say it very happily, but it is a very sad topic. Mm. All right, guys. We will catch you next episode.
Catch you on the flip side. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. Ciao. Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode or you know someone who might, we would love you to share this with them. If you want to see more, please follow us on our Instagram at The Psychology Sisters.
Please note, the content shared in this episode is for educational and general informational purposes only and does not replace personalised advice and support from a mental health professional. See you next episode for more spicy science and sexy self-help.